The Destiny Foundation presents Rabbi Beryl Wein's Travels Through Jewish History. This, the 94th tape in the series, is entitled The Family of Israel, delivered in 1988. We hope you enjoy.
Tonight I'm going to talk to you about the Jewish family, the origins of the family of Israel. Judaism, as you all know, is a family religion. And the family always has played an important role in Jewish life. In Jewish history, the family of Israel begins with the sons of Jacob. Jacob is the first family that's entirely Jewish. His 12 sons and his daughter. And from that family springs the entire story of the Jewish people. It is not only an historic story, but it has in it, as all families do, certain genetic overtones, if not peculiarities. And our rabbis in tradition always saw that the peculiar characteristics of the Jewish people, or of groups of Jews, were always reflections of the original characteristics of the Jewish family, of the members of the Jewish family. And the Chumash, the Bible, therefore, spends a considerable amount of time discussing the family, discussing the brothers, discussing our ancestors. The first thing that is obvious is that they were different one from another. They were not only different because there were four mothers, but even those that had the same father and mother as the six sons of Leah and Yaakov were different one from another, and different in a great degree. And our rabbi saw in that an emphasis on the fact that the Jewish people are a nation of individuals, and if we could phrase it perhaps more correctly, individualists. Basically a nonconformist, independent people. And because of that, they're a cantankerous group. Because of that, they are not easily given to unity, they're not easily given to reconciling opinions in a peaceful fashion. In fact, the entire history of the Jewish people, aside from what the outside world has done to us, aside from the persecutions and the exile and all of the bitterness of Jewish history, but the entire history of the Jewish people from the inside is one of bickering, to put it mildly, of cantankerous, very strong personalities, differences of opinion, differences in outlook that sometimes make the goal of unity very elusive. We live in such a time now, but I have a feeling that all times were such a time. And that basic unity of the Jewish people is present, but it doesn't always reflect itself in the behavior of the Jews, one vis-a-vis the other. I don't know how to say it, but except in a family way again, that sometimes in two brothers have a fight and a third person interferes and criticizes one of the brothers, and both brothers then turn around and beat him up, and then they go back to fighting amongst themselves again. That's the nature of the Jewish people. There's a famous, probably apocryphal, but it could be true, that the great Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Kotsk, the Kotzker Rebbe, met his friend Reb Yitzchok of Varka, who was also a famous Rebbe, and they were both very good friends, the two rebbes. But the chassidim of each were pretty violently opposed to each other. They had a feud running for many, many decades. And when they met, so the Rebbe Reb Yitzchok said to him, "I have good news for you, my friend. I've been told that over the past year, the strife between our two groups of Hasidim has died down, and that things are very peaceful now between us. To which the Kotzker replied, "Woe to us," he says, "that means that neither of us have loyal Hasidim." The idea that's involved there is that there are matters of principle that are not easily reconciled. And in the Jewish world, that has been present from the beginning. That's the story of our family. That's the story of the tribes of Israel. Different people with different outlooks on life, different ways of expressing themselves. And therefore, it is not without friction. The Torah, in fact, is probably meant as the lubricating oil in the engine of the Jewish people, to help us somehow live with the friction. But the friction is never eliminated. And to go back to the story of the Kotzker, it may not be good if it would be eliminated. And we all long for a placid, tranquil existence. But in terms of ultimate good, of ultimate advance, of ultimate spirituality, peace is not always a blessing, because peace lulls and seduces one into a great deal of self-satisfaction. Whereas the necessity for competition, the necessity for confronting other people's ideas, the necessity for confronting other people, period, for confronting my relatives, period, does do something. It hones a person. It brings a person to a certain level of achievement. So that has to be understood, that the Chumash, when it describes us, the 12 brothers, and describes us the family of Israel, lays down the basic foundation that the family of Israel is not monolithic, it is not cut of the same cloth even, but that each one of the brothers is individualistic almost to a fault. We see that our father Yaakov recognized that, because in the blessings to his children, he portrayed each of them in a different role. And he gave them each different assignments. It says in the Chumash that Yaakov blessed them, each one according to his own blessing. And by that, it's obviously understood that the blessing to a person should be according to the talents that he has and according to his abilities to fulfill it. Right? To bless someone that's 4'8" that he should be in the NBA is not realistic. And to bless someone with an inferior IQ that somehow he should devote his life, all of his life, to study is also not realistic. And to take someone that has a great mercantile talent in merchandise and in business, etc., and to make him an ivory tower professor, I don't know if you do him a favor. I really don't know if you do him a favor. That's one of the strange phenomena of our time, is that all successful businessmen want that their children should be doctors, who are notoriously not good businessmen. As though there's a stigma attached to being a businessman. And that type of blessing isn't always a blessing. It really isn't. You get a lot of dissatisfied doctors. There are other things that move within them. And I don't single doctors out solely. I just use them as an example because there's a doctor in the audience. But necessity of giving a proper blessing to each and every child, any parent that has children realizes that each child is a different world unto himself or herself, and that even though they may be biologically the same, even if they are biologically identical twins, you're talking about just two worlds, two different people. And our father Yaakov realized that, and that ish kefi birchoso, each one according to his blessing. So he made Yehuda the king, and he made Levi the priest, and he made Yisachar the scholar, and he made Zvulun the merchant. He divided up the tasks of the nation amongst the various tribes, amongst the various groups in the family. And that insight, that cleverness, that almost prophetic insight as to how the Jewish people would be constituted is part of the makeup of the Jewish people till today. So, if I may, I would like to give a short synopsis of the brothers and what we know of them and the historic trends that each one generated, and see how the Jewish family was created from that. Our rabbis, by the way, say that the 12 brothers, each of them was a righteous, pious person. The words in the Talmud were that Shelo hoya bohen shum dofi. There was no room for doubting their motives and their spectacular personalities. Nevertheless, each one was different, and the difference was of major consequence. Our rabbis, first of all, dwell upon the number 12. 12 is, again, one of the magic numbers that exists. 7 is such a magic number. 70 is a magic number. 39. There are certain, what you could say, are particularly important primary numbers in Jewish life and Jewish history. Well, 12 is one of them. Our rabbis say that the 12 tribes were because there were 12 loaves of bread on the table, on the holy table, the lechem aponim, the showbread. A rabbi say that in reality, Adam Arishon, original man, should have had 12 descendants. 12 was held to be a unit. I don't know, maybe that's where we get a dozen eggs from. I know, but in the world also, 12 occupies a certain place that, for instance, 11 does not. And the 12 tribes of Israel, our rabbis say, were the fact that there are 12 gates to heaven. And every tribe, so to speak, has its own pipeline, its own highway, its own conduit to heaven. And that the prayers and the wishes and the talents of that tribe only work in its conduit. Again, you have the same idea, that you can't take an interchange and expect that everything should work well. We could understand that today in terms of computers, in terms of electricity, in terms of other things that we know, that you cannot mix conduits, you cannot mix wires. You get a negative reaction, if not an explosion. Well, the rabbi said the same thing exists in the spiritual world, and that those are the 12 tribes. So the 12 tribes of Israel, the Jewish family, so they said it themselves, Kulonu b'nei ish echad nochnu. We are all the son of one father. So there is a genetic link that binds us. And that genetic link is our father Jacob, and back to Yitzchak, and back to Avraham Avinu. That's the genetic link that binds us. But each one of the tribes contributed a gift, an element to Jewish life that the other tribe did not. So for instance, Reuven is seen in Jewish tradition as being the father of tshuva, of the idea of repentance, because in the Chumash, Reuven is portrayed as having done something which is indefensible. He meddled in his father's private, intimate affairs. So even though his motives were good and he wanted to take up the defense of his mother, the honor of his mother, etc., but nevertheless it was none of his business, and what he did was wrong. And he spent the rest of his life searching for a way to obtain not only forgiveness, but searching for a way to make it right. Even though Yehuda himself, in the words of the Medrash, gives credit, I mean, Reuven himself gives credit to Yehuda for inspiring him to do the tshuva, but Reuven becomes the symbol of tshuva in Jewish life, the symbol of repentance. It's also, therefore, somewhat of a tragic figure, a tragic symbol, because it's someone who had a position of exalted greatness and forfeited it, lost it. And the marvelous thing about tshuva is that it can patch up everything between you and God, but it doesn't restore you to your former position. It doesn't change what happened. For instance, there's a halacha that if a kohen accidentally murdered someone, which is a shaila, unfortunate, we have today quite often. Let's say he was involved in a motor accident, and God forbid somebody was killed because of him. So even though he may be acquitted in the court, and even though he may, in terms of liability, legal liability, monetary liability, not have to pay. But the halacha is that he can no longer bless the people. He's excluded from that. Even though it's not his fault, or even though he's sorry. But that's it. So that's an example of tshuva, that tshuva fixes it up, but it doesn't make it the way it was before. I think the best example is that if you have a very fine piece of pottery, and your Polish maid drops it on the floor and it breaks, and you have it restored perfectly and glued back together again, if it's usable, it's perfect, but it's just not what it was. It'll never be what it was. That's the idea of tshuva also. Tshuva accomplishes everything. It makes the person even greater, but it's still not what it was. It's a different status. And Reuven is representative of that. That idea, that personality in Jewish life, Reuven is representative of. And because of that, we find that that Reuven is not portrayed in the Chumash in an especially positive light. He's portrayed as someone whom the brothers don't really deal with as their leader. His suggestion to try and save Joseph, they don't even wait for him to come back to sell Joseph. They do it without him. His idea to his father that to allow Benjamin to go down to Egypt, and that he will guarantee Benjamin's return by the lives of his own two children, so that his father rejects that as being essentially a foolish proposal. And even on his deathbed, we find that our father Yaakov could not restrain himself from criticizing Reuven. And the tribe of Reuven, throughout its history, suffers from that stigma. It never assumed the role of leadership. And in fact, by opting to take property east of the Jordan River, in Transjordan, and taking part of the Golan, it went into exile earlier than any of the other tribes of Israel. And as one of the 10 tribes, it really disappeared as a force in Jewish history and the continuation of Jewish history after the time of the First Temple. Shimon, the second son, is seen as the man of war. Shimon on the flag of his tribe had a picture of the city of Shechem. It's a commemoration of a victory of arms. So there's no question that the Jewish people need arms, and there's no question they need a strong army, and there's no question that that if were not for Shimon, who knows what would have happened at Shechem, and they wouldn't have got Dinah out, etc. But on the other hand, we see that his father Yaakov gave him less than full approval for the act that he and Levi did. And again, on his deathbed, he criticizes them very strongly. And he also moved to mitigate that forcefulness, to mitigate that strength, to make certain that it wouldn't happen again. And therefore he said he will scatter them among the Jewish people. He won't let them live as one unit. Because if they lived as one unit, then they would be too powerful. Then it would be a militaristic Sparta-like state. It would be the army Iberalis. And therefore, as what is the most non-military state that one can be in? So that's education, teaching. He made them the teachers of Israel, which is a humbling experience. If you've ever taught children, you know how humbling that is. If you've ever had to spend time discussing their child with parents, you know how humbling that is. And it was never the most well-paying job in the history of the world. And in the time of the Tanakh, the teachers traveled to the students. Today, to a certain extent, it's different. I mean, we have established schools, and students from many different places come to the school. But that was not the case in the time of the First Temple, where the teachers basically were circuit riders. They traveled and conducted classes where they traveled to. So therefore, the tribe of Shimon was scattered throughout the Jewish people. In terms of their ancestral homeland in Palestine, the tribe of Shimon was absorbed by the larger tribe of Yehuda. Shimon had property in the south, near Hebron. That was absorbed by Yehuda. They also had some property in the north, near the Sea of Galilee and the Galilean hills. That also was absorbed, pretty much absorbed by the surrounding powerful tribes. And the tribe of Shimon was the smallest of all the tribes, the least of the tribes in terms of numbers. In the census that occurs in the Chumash Bamidbar a number of times, that tribe does not gain population, it loses population, and it remains the smallest of the tribes. That's because in the plague that occurred in the desert, regarding the immorality of the Jewish people with the daughters of Midian, most of the dead came from the tribe of Shimon. And it was the prince of the tribe of Shimon, the leader of the tribe of Shimon, Zimri, who was struck dead by Pinchas. And that tribe suffered the full effects of that bad story. And in fact, our rabbis say it succinctly. They say the good wine and the good life took them away from the Jewish people. So if you want to cure somebody from good wine and good life, you certainly make them a teacher. That'll do it. That'll disabuse them of any of those thoughts. So Shimon's brother, Levi, so it's Shimon v'Levi Achim Heim. Shimon and Levi were brothers. Brothers means that they were, out of all the brothers, they were the closest to each other. They were a tandem, a team. They operated together. They operated in Shechem together. They were the ones that took care of Yosef. And Yosef himself feared them. Together, they weren't two. I mean, it was a geometrical type of thing. It was not an arithmetical progression. It was a geometrical progression. They were not two. They were 100 if you put them both together. They were just uncontrollable. Therefore, we've seen in the Chumash that Yosef chose to arrest Shimon in order to separate him from Levi, because if he would have let him with Levi, and then they would get together and say, hey, who does this guy think he is? What is he doing here? We'll take care of this town too. And Joseph was really frightened of the fact that such a thing could occur. And therefore he moves to separate them. So what happens to Levi is similar to what happens to Shimon. Levi becomes the symbol of, and remains till today, the symbol of Jewish public service. If Shimon was education, Levi was the public servant. He was the Kohen, he was the Levi. He lived off the public, he lived off of their goodwill. If you're dependent upon public goodwill, you'd be surprised what a pleasant personality you can develop. You'd be surprised how much guff you can take without having to respond in kind. And Levi developed that. Levi becomes represented really by the great man Aaron, who was the first high priest of Israel, and Levi becomes a symbol of peace and of tranquility and of compromise and of serving God and of really being removed from ordinary life and being set aside for public life. They're the civil service of the Jewish people, if we could use that word. And that, again, was meant to... it's a complete turnaround from his original personality, because the original personality of Levi and Shimon were of danger... Those personalities were of dangerous consequences. Together, it was a mix that was very volatile. Levi, our rabbis say, was the only one of the tribes that did not worship idols either in Egypt or in the desert. And Levi was the only one of the tribes that was not enslaved in Egypt, did not bear the burden of actual physical slavery. Levi always was set aside, special tribe. Levi lived the longest of the brothers, and it is from Levi that the leaders of the Jewish people came. Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam, all are grandchildren of Levi, descended from him, and he is the progenitor, therefore, really of the future of the Jewish people. This brings us to the fourth member of the family, of Leah's family, and that's Yehuda, who is the Jewish people. Our rabbis say that why does it says in the pasuk Yehuda ato yoducho achecho, you Yehuda, your brothers will acknowledge you, your brothers will serve you. So the Medrash says, what does it mean your brothers will acknowledge you? He said they'll be called Jews. They'll be called on your name. We're not called Reubenites or Levites or Simonites. We're called Jews. Yehudim, that's been the name of the Jewish people. And that is because Yehuda is the brother that more than any other brother set the tone for Jewish life. And it is his stock, both genetically and spiritually, that has survived. He is the brother, the brother. And he represents strength. He's blessed as being the lion. He's the physical strength, spiritual strength, leadership, tenacity, survivability. All of the characteristics of the Jewish people are placed into Yehuda. Our rabbis say that therefore that's why Yehuda has God's name in his name. It's a yud and a hey and a vav, and then there's another hey. Right, the Dalit is the only thing in that's not God's name. So out of all the tribes, he has God's name. Because of the fact that Yehuda is spelled with God's name, so many pious Jews changed the spelling of Yehuda from Yud Hey Vav Dalit Hey to Yud Hey Vav Dalit Aleph, to spell it with an Aleph at the end. So in case you ever forgot to put in the Dalit, there would be no danger. Whereas if you spelled it with a hey, then it was God's name. If you didn't write the Dalit, then you would have written God's name and the paper couldn't be destroyed and other problems could exist. So throughout the ages, there have been many, many pious Jews who have purposely misspelled their name in order to prevent that from happening. But in the Chumash, in the Tanakh, we see that Yehuda's called on God's name. God rather allows his name to be part of Yehuda's makeup. And that's a statement about the eternity of Yehuda. That's a statement about the eternity of the Jewish people. We read in the Chumash that Yehuda's own family was sustained through a story which is difficult to deal with. The story of Yehuda and Tamar. But that's a fact in Jewish history also. We will come across in the Tanakh many stories. The Tanakh is not like a newspaper. It's not the Jewish press where you can buy an ad to get in and edit it and get out. You can put whatever you want, right? In the Chumash, in the Tanakh, when it says, and that's never erased. So there's a story that is basically uncomplimentary. And we find other such stories later about descendants of Yehuda, about other people. Unlikely marriages, unlikely parents. And yet it is almost invariably true that it is from those unlikely liaisons, from those even seemingly illicit liaisons, that the future and the survivability of the Jewish people is built. That's one of the paradoxes that all the commentators deal with in understanding Jewish history and understanding the Tanakh generally. And even in later history, one could even say in our time, there are unlikely people and unlikely events that God uses for historic purposes, that we would not advance those people or those events as being the proper turning points for Jewish history. If we had to choose whom the Melech HaMashiach would be descended from, we would not tell publicly the story of Yehuda and Tamar, of David and Bathsheba, and other stories that exist in the Tanakh. But God has told the story. And he's told it in a way that even though they did not sin, but nevertheless the story stands on its own. The story has its own import and its own message for us. It's not easily discarded. And because of that, therefore, there's a great historic lesson here. Yehuda rises from every one of his problems. That is the great hallmark of Yehuda. Again, I mentioned it as survivability. Sheva yipol tzadik vakom. Shlomo HaMelech says that the righteous person falls seven times, vakom, and he arises. So the Talmud says that that pasuk refers to Yehuda. Yehuda falls a lot of times in the Chumash. But vakom, every time he rises, he is able to sustain the blow and move on, and in his tenacity to prevail. So if you'll think about it, you'll see that that characteristic, that genetic characteristic of our father Yehuda became the prime characteristic of the Jewish people. If you'll say one characteristic about the Jewish people, it is not its scholarship, which is great, or its intelligence, which is great, or its philanthropy, which is great, or its brilliance, whatever. The one thing about the Jewish people is that it's here. That it has survived, that it has been able to overcome all of the enormous odds of history. And the Chumash comes to point that out to us, and that's the story of Yehuda. Yehuda survives a story with Tamar, he survives a story with Yosef, he survives being deposed by his brothers. All of the stories that happened to him, any one incident would be enough to crush a lesser person. At least remove him from the center of the arena. Not so Yehuda. And therefore, that's why he's the father of the Jewish people. That's why we're called Jews. That's why we're Yehudim. Because it's not just that we're descended from his tribe, but we are descended from him in our unending ability to rise. The rabbis interpret that verse that I mentioned to you, Sheva Yipol Tzadik Vakom, that the righteous person falls seven times and rises, that the difference between the righteous person and the evil person is that the evil person doesn't rise. The difference is not that they both, because they both fall. But what happens after the fall? So the Rosh says, as long as I'm down here, I might as well enjoy it. What's the use? That is the nature of evil. The nature of evil is that it never stops to think. Once it gets into the habit, it never stops to think. It's never able to rise. And we become prisoners of our own habits and our own weaknesses. Yehuda is the example of Sheva Yipol Tzadik Vokom, a righteous person who, even though he is tripped up in life, even though things happen to him that he does not wish to happen to him, and he is subjected to all sorts of great problems, Vakom, he rises. He's able to get up. That's a remarkable quality. That's one that should be remembered. That's part of the Jewish family. That's the central part of the Jewish family, the survivability. That's something that the rest of the world does not have. It's not meant as a criticism, it's just as an historical statement. There's no civilization that can afford to lose and survive. It just does not happen in history. When Rome falls, so that's the end of Rome. The British Empire fell, that's the end of the British Empire. It's over. But not so with the Jewish people. Now, the next brother, really two brothers, Zvulun and Yisachar, that completes the six children of Leah. Zvulun and Yisachar. Zvulun and Yisachar are always seen in Jewish tradition as a team, as a cooperative venture, which again is an expression of how to view Jewish life, how to understand the Jewish people and how to view Jewish life generally. Zvulun is the great merchant, the great businessman. Zvulun lived on the coast. He was the partner with the Phoenicians, the ancient Phoenicians, in traveling throughout the Mediterranean and establishing the trade routes, both east and west. And Zvulun also had, since he lived on the coast, he also had the income from the little snail, probably like a snail, the chalazon. That little snail has a pouch, like a goiter. And that pouch contains blood. They used to catch that snail and with a syringe-type instrument extract the blood from the pouch, and that blood became the dye for tchelis, for the royal blue, for the turquoise blue, royal blue. We don't know exactly, but apparently royal blue would be closer to our ideas of colors, at least. And that was used for the tzitzis. Now, we don't have tchelis today, though in the late 1800s, The Radziner Rebbe, Reb Henoch Leiner, Gershon Henoch Leiner, traveled to Italy and he spent years researching the matter and he claimed to have found this snail. And he extracted blood from it and he made the dye and he sold tchelis throughout Europe. Now today it's basically his chassidim. Mostly his chassidim that wear the blue string. Did you ever see? It's a royal blue string. And it's what tzitzis are supposed to look like. But the rest of the Jewish world has not adopted it because they didn't accept his proofs to the validity of the fact that that was the chalazon. But in any event, if the chalazon would have been a hit, he could have supported the Radziner Chassidim very handsomely. And Zvulun, part of the wealth of Zvulun was that the chalazon was found on its shore, and they made a business. They were the ones that used it for the dye. But they were great merchants. Their ships plied the Mediterranean, and their business acumen, it's the first mention that we find even in non-Jewish sources of the business acumen of Jews. That the sailors of Zvulun, the merchants of Zvulun, were well known in the ancient world for being good businessmen, for being traders, for being people with initiative, for people able to see a new idea and be able to open new routes. And they had a partnership with the Phoenicians. And therefore we'll see later that when the temple was built in Jerusalem, the Phoenicians participated. Hiram, the king of Tyre, you know, the founder of the Freemasons, he participated in the building of the Beis HaMikdash, and that was because of the alliance of Zvulun, who lived next to the Phoenicians and was their partner in many, many a business venture. Now, Zvulun had a brother, Yisachar. Yisachar is described in the Chumash as being someone that carries a burden. Yisachar Chamor Gorem. It's like a donkey that was the beast of burden in the ancient world. It's the beast of burden in the Arab world today and many other places. It can carry enormous weights, many, many times its body weight. For instance, we think that an elephant is a tremendous beast of burden, and it is. But relative to its body weight, it is able to carry nowhere near what the little donkey can carry. And Yisachar was compared to that donkey. And what did Yisachar carry? He carried the burden of Torah. Yisachar was the Talmud Chochem. He carried the burden of Torah. Now, scholarship was always seen in Jewish life as a burden. It was never said, you know, oh, what does he do? He's learning, he's not doing anything, right? He doesn't do anything productive. That was never said. That's a fairly modern problem. But we do find in the Talmud the remarks that the non-learners said about the learners, remarks that were less than complimentary. But the scholar always held an exalted role in Jewish life. And part of the exalted role was that by simply being a scholar, he was entitled to public support. Entitled to it. That was a matter of right. It wasn't a matter of charity. It was a matter of right. Because, really, three reasons. A, the preservation of scholarship was the most necessary requirement for the survival of the Jewish people. Without Torah knowledge, without scholarship, without intellectual ability, the Jewish people could not survive. And therefore, they were the ones who contributed most directly to Jewish survival, hence they're entitled to be supported. Second reason is that they were entitled to support because of the fact that the study of Torah, to a great extent, required that they not really be engaged in other pursuits, that they be selflessly and almost solely dedicated to the study of Torah, because if they would be in other things, then the distractions would prove too overwhelming. Now, even though until the time of the 13th century, really the beginning of the 14th century, rabbis were not paid for being rabbis, and almost all Jewish scholars had to support themselves somehow. Nevertheless, there was always a tacit understanding in the community that the scholars were to be helped. They were freed from the taxes of the community. They were entitled to certain benefits. Their children were entitled to education. All of these things were granted, again, not as a matter of charity or of welfare, but as a matter of right. So Zvulun supported Yisachar. That was the the compact. That was the agreement. And it's remained so until today. In fact, it's called Zvulun Yisachar. And there are literal contracts, you know, the contracts drawn up in writing that are signed, in which one person says to the other person, you sit and learn, and I'm going to go into business, and we'll split it 50-50, meaning you're entitled to 50% of the profits, and I'm entitled to 50% of your learning. So that after 120 years after our death, when we go to heaven, so in heaven I can show the contract and say, I'm entitled to 50% of this person's learning. And I have seen such contracts. I don't know whether you've actually seen them, but they do exist, and they are popular among certain circles. And the truth of the matter is that if you can find the right person who is learning, you can make an excellent deal. It's like sometimes I know someone in New York who developed. And continues to develop property, and sometimes a guy, you know, gave him $5,000 and bought in on this thing, and he developed it, and it became a $100 million project, right? And his $5,000 became worth $250,000, $500,000. Now that's a good investment, right? We understand that that's a good investment. So too, the Yisachar Zvulun many times turns out to be a tremendous investment. Sometimes you get a lunkhead, right? That also can happen, right? The Chafetz Chaim used to say, we say in benching, Shelo nevosh v'lo nikolem lolom voed. We should not be embarrassed lolom voed forever. So he said, what is embarrassed forever? So he said that embarrassed forever is that sometimes people give you money because they think you're studying for them. Or they give you money because they think that you're a great man. Or they contribute money because they think your institution is really doing a good job. And it turns out it's not the way they thought. It's not necessarily the type of thing that they thought. So then you're embarrassed in the world to come, because the guy comes up in the world to come, and they said to him, well, where did you learn Torah? He says, I didn't learn Torah, but I got to deal with, you know, Yankel Shmerel. Say, hey, Yankel Shmerel, he bottled the whole day. He never learned. He got half of nothing. Or he said, I didn't learn, but I gave my money to XYZ Yeshiva, and all the Torah there I have a share in. So they look up XYZ Yeshiva and say, nobody ever learned there, right? There's nothing. So the Chofetz Chaim said that that's what it says, lo nevo shelo nikolem leolam voed. In the world to come, we shouldn't be embarrassed, shouldn't be ashamed. But that set up between brothers, that's Zvulun Yisachar. And that's a basic underlying theme in Jewish life. And you find a lot of resentment on both sides, even today. Right, the guys that are learning complain that they're not treated right, and the ones who say these guys are batlonim, right? They're draft dodgers. They don't want to go to the army. They don't want to work. They don't want to do anything. They just sit. What do you know who needs them? That's from time immemorial. That's not a new problem, and the words haven't been invented now. But central to the idea of the Jewish family, which is the Jewish nation, is the fact that a certain cadre of people were always set aside and were always supported by the rest of the community. And in the rest of the community supporting them, everybody had a share in their spiritual and intellectual and scholarly attainments. But on the other hand, they were deserving of that support. And again, that support was never to be seen as a welfare or a charitable contribution. It was seen as a matter of right, as an investment in the survival of the Jewish people and in my own ability to have credit for it. All right, this brings us to the four brothers that were descended from Bilhah and Zilpah. So you have Gad, Asher, Dan, and Naphtali. So God again was warrior people, and Usher was agricultural, and Don was a very large, God was a very large tribe, and Don was also a famous warlike tribe, and that's the story of Shimshon. And Naphtali lived in the northern Galilee as well. These four tribes, if I say so I don't mean, God forbid, to demean, to give the wrong impression, but those four tribes are like the masses of the Jewish people. And they each had their own greatness and their own quality to them. The final two brothers are the really the source of friction, at least one of the brothers, the continual source of friction within the Jewish people, and remains so till today. And that's Yosef, tribe of Yosef. So Yosef was the beloved son of Rachel, and he was the son of Yaakov, whom Yaakov loved the most, and he was the one who most resembled his father. And he is the one whom the brothers could not live with peacefully. Under no circumstances could the brothers live with him peacefully. And because they could not, so you had the sad events which are recorded, how the Jewish people came to Egypt. Yosef was a man of enormous talents, and probably the most brilliant of the brothers. He is the personification of Jewish brilliance. But he's the personification of Jewish brilliance, which is harnessed, which is within the parameters of Jewish morality. Because Jewish brilliance outside the parameter of Jewish morality becomes many times destructive, full of self-hatred. It's not beneficial either for the Jews or for the world. And in our long history, there are unfortunately hundreds, if not thousands, of such examples of the brilliance of Jews that turns negative, that turns nihilistic, that really has no place in the world, that isn't part of the civilization and the civilizing process. There's a great phrase that's used many times by historians, non-Jewish Jews. That's Yosef without the restraint of Torah. That's non-Jewish Jews. It's Heinrich Heine. It's Karl Marx. To a certain extent, Freud. To a certain extent, others who have within themselves tremendous Jewish brilliance, who have the gift of genius, but because they do not have the necessary moral inhibitions which would channel it and harness it, it becomes negative and not positive. And therefore, that's the greatness of Yosef, is that we see what genius can do harnessed. Yosef saves the world. Yosef gives food to everyone. Yosef is able to build Egypt into the greatest empire of its time. And its empire will last after the death of Yosef for almost 200 years, which is a long time as empires go. And Yosef is given the role of the competitor to Yehuda for the throne of Israel. The first king of Israel comes from Binyamin, Shaul HaMelech, from Yosef's brother. And then after Yehuda takes the reins of monarchy with David and Shlomo, so the rebellion against Shlomo is led by Yosef's descendant, by Yeravam ben Nevot from the tribe of Ephraim. Yehoshua was from the tribe of Ephraim, from Yosef. Yosef is the balance force. He is the opposite wheel to Yehuda. And that brings about friction, and it brought about terrible friction. We'll see later in the lecture series when we talk about the 10 tribes of Israel, about the northern kingdom of Israel. Brought civil war, literally civil war, to the Jewish people. The seeds of that are planted long, long before. And they just are two tribes that don't see eye to eye, that it's hard to live with. and even comes in terms of discussing the Messiah and Jewish destiny. So the Talmud tells us there's Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. There's two Mashiachs. Each one has his own. So the eventual Mashiach is Mashiach ben David, the final one. The one that will spark the entire redemption. But there's a Mashiach ben Yosef also. It's like almost like an anti-Mashiach. And that is part of the struggle between Yosef and Yehuda. A struggle that remains till today. Within the Jewish people, there are diverse elements that if you look at them, they are almost irreconcilable. And they're competitive. They're not quiet about it. That's also planted within the Jewish family. And then you have Binyamin, the last of the brothers. So he's the guiltless Jew. See, both Yosef and Binyamin are called tzaddikim, righteous. Yes, Yosef atzaddik, Binyamin atzaddik. But the rabbis explained the great difference between the two. Joseph is guiltless, but he's controversial. Joseph is a tzaddik, but not everybody will vote him into that position. God is the one that puts that imprimatur upon him. Binyamin, human beings put that imprimatur upon him. Binyamin is... none of the brothers have a bad word to say about Binyamin. Everybody has one uncle like that, or one cousin. One nice guy. One guy that everybody can agree upon. And that's the role that Binyamin has. Binyamin is the... therefore, Binyamin is the brother who never participated in the battle between Joseph and his brothers. Binyamin is the only one of the brothers born in Eretz Yisrael. He's not born in Chutz Laaretz, outside the land of Israel. He's born only in the land of... he's the only brother born in the land of Israel. Binyamin is the one that did not bow ever to Esav, because he wasn't alive when Esav came and met with all the rest of the family, so he never had to bow to him. Binyamin is protected, so to speak, from all the vicissitudes of life that made the other brothers' lives so stormy. And that's why our rabbis say that the Beis HaMikdash was built, the temple in Jerusalem was built upon the land of Binyamin. And that the city of Jerusalem is shared by Binyamin and by Yehuda. That the Beis HaMikdash is built on the plot of land of Binyamin. Because of the fact that he's above it all. So you need such a person in the family too. You need someone who's altruistic, who is still has innocence to him, who has all of those positive qualities, and is not involved in all the dirt and the problems and the struggles, etc. You have somebody left who's not sullied by everything else that happens. And that's a great quality. So when you put all of these shvatim together, you see that you have a varied picture. That the family of Israel has many, many colors to it. And it has many personalities, all of whom are strong personalities, all of whom are great individualists, and not easy people to reconcile one to another. And by having such a wide variety, the Torah has immediately placed us on notice, on clear notice, as to what's going to be. What is the nature of the Jewish people going to be? Is it going to be an easy people? No. It's going to be a divided people. It's going to be a cantankerous people. It's going to be full of friction and problems. But it's going to be a family. Basically, Kulonu bnei ish echad nochnu. We are all children of one father. We all have one heritage, one common history, and therefore one common destiny. So in the description of the tribes of Israel, in the description of the basic Jewish family, we have not only a story of 12 short biographies, but we have the prophecy regarding what will happen to them and their children and their grandchildren, to all Jewish generations, to the great Jewish family, until the end of time itself.
This concludes Lecture 94 on the Family of Israel by Rabbi Beryl Wein. For information, please contact the Destiny Foundation at 1-800-499-WINE. That's 1-800-499-9346. We can also be reached by email at info@jewishdestiny.com. Shop online at www.rabbiwine.com. Due to copyright laws, we kindly request that there be no duplication of this lecture.